Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. This is the first episode of 2025, although it was recorded in December of 2024. As I've been saying in my latest intros, please stay tuned in the coming weeks for more details about the Boardroom Governance Podcast Summit to celebrate its fifth year anniversary, including how you can register and secure your spot. In the meantime, if you have any ideas for the summit or are interested in sponsorship opportunities, please feel free to email me at evanepstein@substack.com or epsteinevan@uclawsf.edu. Okay, back to the show. In this episode, I talk with Ben Joseloff, a partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore, and a former White House and U.S. Treasury Department official. Ben served as CFIUS lead counsel. So in this episode, we've taken a closer look at CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. We discuss the evolution of CFIUS in safeguarding U.S. national security through foreign investment reviews. Key topics include notable CFIUS cases, trends in transaction reviews, and the impact of upcoming regulations on outbound investments and cryptocurrency. Ben urges corporate leaders to align their strategies with national security concerns, highlighting the intersection of corporate governance and geopolitical dynamics. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can also contribute by subscribing to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. The Boardroom Governance Podcast is sponsored by the American College of Governance Counsel. The ACGC is a professional association of lawyers and academics in the U.S. and Canada, widely recognized for the expertise and achievements in the field of corporate governance. The ACGC was founded by some of the most prominent U.S. corporate governance lawyers, and today the organization includes over 150 practitioners and academics. The ACGC's mission is to promote a high level of professional standards among governance lawyers, along with a better understanding and broader adoption of best practices within business organizations. You should check out their website at amgovcollege.org. That is amgovcollege.org. Ben, it is so good to see you after so long. We met at Stanford years ago. We actually played rugby together. And it's great to reconnect, particularly because you've become an expert in a field that is very important for boards, very important for companies, which is CFIUS. And we'll dive into that. But first of all, thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Evan. It's wonderful to be with you and great to see you again after so many years. And I'm thrilled and honored and privileged to be talking to you.
All right. So let's get started. I always start with the origin story of my guest. So give us a little bit of a sense where you're born, where you grew up, and we'll move from there to your current position as a partner at Cravath.
Yeah, great. So I was born in Tokyo, Japan.
Wow. I didn't know that. There you go.
So slightly interesting fact about me. My dad was a foreign correspondent. He was a journalist, and he started out with a company called UPI, United Press International, and then went over to CBS News, and he was a bureau chief in London and then Moscow and then Tokyo. Hmm. So I was born in Tokyo. My older sister was born in Helsinki, Finland, actually, because my parents were working, living in Moscow at the time, and hospitals weren't great, so they flew over to Finland to have my sister. Hmm. But yeah, very, very interesting. You know, kind of growing up abroad, kind of gave me a different view on the United States, I think, than some people. Lived there until I was about seven, and then moved to Connecticut when my dad's job kind of transferred to New York.
So do you keep your Japanese from your early age?
I wish. You know, when we moved here, I was pretty good for a seven-year-old. But, mm-hmm. As you know well, languages, if you don't use it, yeah. Use it, right?
Yeah.
So some of it is still somewhere in my head, but not as, not as much as it should be.
Okay. So you moved there?
So moved to Connecticut, grew up in Connecticut, kind of the rest of my childhood, went to New York University undergrad. I studied classics and linguistics, which, again, is something slightly different, a lot of Latin and Greek and history and more languages. But I really had a great time there. I was kind of, learning all foundations of Western civilization and all that good stuff, right? But at some point, you know, decided that if you're a classics major, unless you want to be a, you know, Latin or Greek professor, you've got to kind of find something else to do, right?
Yeah.
And I think because of my childhood and my upbringing, I'd always been interested in international affairs and policy and politics. And so I, you know, during my summers at NYU, I interned first in local government and then for U.S. congressmen. After I graduated, I went to work for that same congressman. His name was Chris Shays. He was a representative of Connecticut. Worked for him for about a year, and that really kind of solidified my desire to go to law school, because I saw, you know, just how many lawyers were involved in policymaking and the political process, and how having that background could really help if you were interested in that field. So then went to Stanford, which is, of course, where we met. At Stanford, I focused on, you know, mostly international law classes, kind of policy, national security, because that was, you know, my main interest and what I, you know, had hoped to do after leaving law school. But interestingly, while I was there, you know, one of the great things about Stanford, as you know, is you get to do a lot of cross-pollinization, right? You can take classes at other schools and you meet people from other schools and that kind of thing, and met people with more of kind of a business, corporate and transactional interest. And, you know, I became interested in some of those issues and realized quite quickly, I think, that you can't, you know, really understand policy and politics unless you also understand the economic side of it and the corporate side of it and what business leaders are thinking and what boardrooms are thinking. And so after I graduated and after I clerked for a federal judge for a year, I joined Cravath in the corporate department because I really wanted to learn more about how the business world works.
Although you did jump your stint in Kabul.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you. So, right. So I graduated law school in 2008. I clerked for a year, which took me to kind of the end of the summer of 2009. And this was like financial crisis times, right? When a lot of law firms were allowing incoming associates to kind of defer their start dates if they wanted to do an interesting, you know, public service project or, you know, nonprofit project or something like that. And during law school, I had worked on a project called the Afghanistan Legal Education Project, which I had kind of co-founded with some friends, which was trying to help the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul set up a law school. The program was going well, but up until that point, Stanford didn't have anybody kind of on the ground in Afghanistan as a representative of the project. We were doing it all kind of remotely. And at the time, they were American University of Afghanistan, AUAF, was really trying to increase and solidify its legal education program. And so they asked me if I would kind of be willing to go over there. So I did. I was in Kabul for about 4 months in late 2009. Helping AUAF establish a legal program.
How was that experience?
It was an amazing experience, you know, different than anything that I'd done before. It was a time when the security situation was tolerable, right? I mean, you know, it was clearly not the worst times. There was always going to be some safety issues, but it was safe enough for me to go and to work on the project. And it was just an amazing experience, you know, working with young Afghan men and women who at that point were really excited about the direction their country was going and, you know, rule of law and democracy and all these things. You know, getting to work with them every day was exhilarating and it was uplifting and, it made me more optimistic. Of course, you know, since then, it's all gone in a very different direction, which has been disappointing and disheartening and extremely unfortunate and all those things. But while I was there, it was wonderful.
And I do recall that there was a bombing or some accident where people affiliated at Stanford actually got impacted, right?
Yeah, the university was attacked some years after I was there. And the person, one of the people who was kind of in a similar role to what I played, who was somebody who had studied at Stanford and was there at AUAF working on the legal education program, was killed, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. So then you come back to the U.S. and you go to Cravath.
Right. So I started at Cravath in January of 2010. And as I said, you know, I was really interested in kind of learning more of the corporate world and the business world and transactional world. And so Cravath is a great place to do that because it has a rotation system where essentially you travel through different practice groups within your chosen department for your entire career as an associate. And so I was exposed to, you know, mergers and acquisitions, capital markets, syndicated lending, really a wide range of different types of business transactions, and getting to work with, you know, general counsels and boardrooms and that kind of thing. So love the experience, demanding, of course, you know, as most law firms are. But, you know, it got to a point where I'd been there for a little less than, you know, 5 years. And, you know, had to decide, is this something that I want to stay and do this kind of for the rest of my career? Or do I want to explore, you know, my first interest, which was kind of more of the policy and international affairs and national security side of things. And so I decided to go, you know, go do that, to go work for the US government. I joined the Treasury Department, which was my first real taste of CFIUS. The office I joined was the office of the Assistant General Counsel for International Affairs at Treasury, which is the legal office responsible for providing advice to kind of CFIUS policymakers. And my first job was as a line attorney, and it was the perfect, you know, kind of unintentionally, because I didn't know much about CFIUS at the time. It was kind of the perfect blend of my national security, international affairs, policy interests, plus my, you know, recent 5 years experience of doing deals, right? And at the time I joined that office, most of the other attorneys in the office had came from litigation backgrounds or, you know, international law backgrounds or, you know, not kind of transactional backgrounds. And so I was able to add some value by being kind of the, you know, the corporate guy, right? The guy who knew the M&A deals. Working in that office. Since then, I think they have staffed up with a lot more people who kind of have similar transactional backgrounds. But at the time, I think that was fairly rare.
And so tell us a little bit about your evolution at the Treasury and your role then with CFIUS that became very central to it.
Yeah, so I was a line attorney for a couple of years, you know, working on CFIUS as well as other issues, other, you know, kind of grab bag of international trade and investment issues. I was then at the beginning of the Trump administration invited to go over to the White House, where I was dual hatted between the National Security Council and the National Economic Council as a director for international trade and investment. And so that was a policy role at the White House rather than a, you know, legal role. So it was interesting moving from kind of the legal side, right, to the policy side or the business side, right, where you're kind of helping make and shape the decisions rather than just kind of advising on the legal aspects of it, right? And that was wonderful because it allowed me to, you know, see from a different vantage point the policymaking process, right? My job at the White House was really one of kind of coordination of various, you know, executive branch agencies and departments working on very difficult policy issues. A lot of it related to CFIUS, a lot of it related to the economic relationship between the United States and China, economic security issues more generally, trade issues. And so it was a great experience. And during that time, we were helping to shape and to get past FIRMA, the Foreign Investment Risk Review Modernization Act in 2018, which really changed CFIUS. It was the biggest change in CFIUS, you know, kind of since the history of CFIUS, right? And we can talk more about that, but that was something very interesting to work on. So I did that for a little over a year, and then went back to the Treasury Department as the lead counsel for CFIUS. And as I'm sure you know, Treasury is the chair of the CFIUS process. And so in my role as lead counsel at Treasury for CFIUS, you know, I was largely providing and managing a team that provided, you know, the kind of most important legal advice to Treasury policymakers in the CFIUS process.
All right. So we can't talk to a better person about CFIUS, and I'm glad to have this conversation with you. First, I've got to say, I did a prior episode with Mario Mancuso with some of the basics of CFIUS. People can go and re-listen that, or let's jump into, you know, the basics, you know, 1975 CFIUS. Let's talk about what it is, and then we'll move, we'll talk about Firma and what, how it was expanded. And then we should talk about, you know, what are the enforcement guidelines and actions and how it has evolved since then?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you're exactly right. So CFIUS kind of as a body was established in 1975 through an executive order. Interestingly, of course, you know, the United States has recognized for much longer than that, that foreign investment in the U.S. isn't always benign, right? And there have been other tools over the years that the government has used to address those issues. There's one really kind of interesting case from the World War I era, where, you know, the German government had established a projectile company in Bridgeport, Connecticut, not too far from where I live now, that, you know, they established it, they set it up. It started buying lots of, you know, gunpowder and shells from all these U.S. defense contractors with the idea of basically just storing them, right? Not actually using them, just storing them so that the defense contractors couldn't fulfill genuine orders from the French and the British, right? So it was this kind of, you know, using an investment, using a U.S. business to achieve a geopolitical aim. Eventually, this plan was kind of found out and by the U.S. government, and it led to one of the initial, you know, legislative tools that the government had to kind of prevent this kind of thing, the Trading with the Enemy Act in 1917. So this just, you know, I just raised this to show that, yes, CFIUS started in 1975, but these issues have been around for much longer, right?
And I also think that FDR also in the Second World War used the power and increasingly to cut off Germany and Russia and trying to curb the investment side of things.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the Trading with the Enemy Act, IEEPA, you know, International Emergency Economic Powers Act, there's been various tools over the years that have been used to address exactly this concern of you know, foreign adversaries using kind of the U.S. open investment environment in ways that are, you know, contrary to our interests, right? But the establishment of CFIUS in 1975 was, you know, largely due to concerns at the time about petrodollars and some, you know, wealthy OPEC countries. This was, of course, following, you know, kind of the oil shock of the early mid 1970s. Concerns about, you know, petrodollars being used to acquire strategic assets in the United States, right? CFIUS then underwent its first kind of major change in the late 80s. When it was established in statute. And of course, at that time, the concern was the rise of Japan, you know, which is one of our closest allies at this point. But, it, you know, back then there was concerns that Japanese companies were buying U.S. companies and could involve strategic assets and that kind of thing. So you see these waves, right, of concern, of kind of policy concerns that then the tool is adapted to address, right? After the 80s, you know, then there was another one in 2007 with the Foreign Investment National Security Act, FINSA, that was precipitated by the Dubai ports controversy. And at that time, the concern was more kind of terrorism relating to the Middle East, right? You just kind of, again, you see these waves of geopolitical concern catalyzing changes to the regulatory tool. And then the last one, the big one, you know, Firma in 2018 was, of course, largely driven by concerns about China, right? So you go from, you know, petrodollars to Japan to terrorism to China, right? And then you see CFIUS as a tool changing to address whatever the geopolitical concern is.
But Firma did something really interesting, which it used to be focused on control transactions. But then Firma was, no, we're going to actually oversee minority investments as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So CFIUS historically was only had jurisdiction over transactions that conferred control to a non-U.S. person. Control was always defined very broadly. Unlike some other regulatory regimes, it's not a bright line ownership test. the definition in the CFIUS regulations is the ability to determine, direct, or decide important matters affecting an entity. Mm-hmm. And CFIUS routinely found control, even its small minority investments, if there was other kind of rights or, you know, indicia of control involved, right? So, for example, you could have a 5% transaction, but if you get an approval right over the hiring and firing of management, or an approval right over the annual budget, or a veto right over expansions of the business in certain ways, CFIUS would have control over that, or CFIUS would have jurisdiction right. over that.
Well, you know what's interesting, and this is, goes to our corporate law background, is in Delaware, it's a huge thing now, control transactions, and we'll hear about Elon Musk. But it's interesting that even in this national security, that's also, it's got its own definition, different to the Chancery Court definition of control. You got the CFIUS definition of control.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the CFIUS definition of control is so broad that it is frequently surprising to people who deal with the definition. Yeah, corporate issues, or even just business people, you know, just boardrooms. I mean, people who just think of it from a business perspective of, oh, you know, this is a 15% investment. That's not a controlling investment. Right. Well, from CFIUS's perspective, it may be.
Well, if you're a board member, right, like there is a theory that, hey, if you're in the board, you're in a position to have governance rights, right? And that may trigger CFIUS jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But the interesting thing about FIRMA was, you know, CFIUS and the U.S. government recognized that even as expansive as that definition of control was, it wasn't enough to address the national security concerns. And what led to that was, you know, there were a lot of transactions being done where, again, primarily the concern was primarily China driven, but the transactions involved, you know, small venture capital type investments in startups in your world, in your neck of the woods, Silicon Valley, right? Yeah. Where the investor might be taking a small equity percentage, maybe not even taking a board seat, but nevertheless getting access to technology or getting access to trade secrets or getting a first look at, you know, the development of some new product, right? And the national security regulators said, well, wait a minute, they're not getting control, but they are getting the things that from a national security perspective we're concerned about, which is access to that material non-public technology. And so that's what FIRMA did. FIRMA said, CFIUS is going to have jurisdiction not only over control transactions, but other transactions that may not confer control, but nevertheless provide the investor some type of access to something that we're concerned about.
And so here it's important to also define that they name certain industries or technologies that have implications to national security. So semiconductor and AI and other industries like that, right? Are there name categories, or it's like a broad authority to national security implications?
Yeah, for CFIUS jurisdictional purposes, this new kind of bucket of non-controlling investments, it's the U.S. business has to be one that's involved with one of three things, one or more of three things: critical technologies, and I'll tell you what that means in a minute, critical infrastructure, or sensitive personal data. So if the U.S. business, the U.S. target business is involved in one of those things, then a minority investment can be picked up if it gives the foreign investor certain rights. The critical technology piece is very interesting. It's defined by reference to U.S. export control laws. So things to which, you know, items to which the U.S. government applies heightened export controls, right? Meaning you would need a license from the U.S. government to export this product or technology to another country. That's how critical technologies is defined for CFIUS purposes. And so you really then, to figure out what's a critical technology for CFIUS purposes, you really have to look at
references
to other export control regimes. And so it's not everything, but it is, you know, it is a large bucket of items, which can be, you know, commodities, software, technology that the U.S. government controls for export.
So let's talk about how the number of transactions that are reviewed have increased. And I know that last year they issued the guidelines. So maybe can you talk about CFIUS? And I should tell you a little story. I was reading the other day, there's a company called AppLovin, which is a tech company, went public in 2021. It's a $110 billion company. And I kind of looked into it and I noticed that in 2016, There was a private equity firm from China that tried to acquire them for $1.6 billion, but then it said it got rejected under CFIUS. And I said, I should talk to Ben about that. So that, you know, it's interesting. It could have been acquired by a Chinese company in 2016, but now it's a thriving $110 billion company in the stock market. In hindsight, you know, things can change. But I think a lot of the transactions people don't necessarily know about.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So in terms of, you know, kind of starting with the beginning of your questions, you know, in terms of numbers of transactions, kind of volume, it has increased significantly over the years. You know, if you were to go back and look at the early 2010s, you know, there was, you know, something on the order of 100 and 150 cases somewhere in that neighborhood that CFIUS was reviewing, which has jumped up to, you know, over 400 cases a year, transactions cases a year more recently. Interestingly, we've started to see that level off, and you know, I'll be very CFIUS once a year, typically in the summer, releases kind of public statistics, and so we'll be very interested to see next year whether that, you know, kind of leveling off or even slight decrease continues, or whether that pushes back up. But just the broad trend, it absolutely has been more, you know, more reviews over time. In terms of, you know, people not knowing about them, one of the interesting things about the CFIUS process is it's largely voluntary. Before FIRMA, it was entirely voluntary, meaning, you know, parties could choose whether or not to file their transactions with CFIUS. One of the reasons that parties do file with CFIUS is once you get approval, the U.S. government can't come back and review your transaction again in the future, right? That's the incentive. It's kind of this safe harbor that, you know, the U.S. government gets one bite at the apple, they approve your deal, and then...
It's sort of like a TSR for antitrust, right?
Yeah. That's right. I mean, it's kind of one bite of the apple and you're done. You know, assuming you didn't lie to them or other unusual circumstances, they can't come, you know, once they've approved it, they can't come back and look again. And historically, because it was this voluntary process, you wanted to incentivize parties to file. And one of the incentives was CFIUS will keep your transaction confidential. CFIUS does not report what transactions that it has reviewed. Material filed with CFIUS is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So, you, Evan, as a researcher, could not go to CFIUS and say, tell me every, you know, a FOIA request for every transaction you review. They'd say, no, we don't have to provide that. And so the confidentiality has been a big part of the process. The only there are a few exceptions to that. The large one is if a transaction is actually prohibited by the President of the United States, then that's released in a public executive order. But those are very rare. You know, there's only been a handful of those, you know, in the entire history of CFIUS.
Well, actually, you should explain, because if the CFIUS process goes at the very end, the president decides. So maybe you should walk through what are the steps. The very last step is giving the authority of the president to give the thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. CFIUS itself, and this is sometimes misunderstood in popular press and type and that type of thing, CFIUS itself does not have the authority to prohibit a transaction. So you hear about CFIUS blocking a deal. No, that's not technically right. CFIUS doesn't block a deal. CFIUS can only recommend to the President of the United States that the president prohibit the transaction. But what happens more frequently than presidential prohibitions is, you know, after a certain amount of time where CFIUS has reviewed the transaction, they will go to the parties and say, we've identified a national security concern arising from this transaction, right? And CFIUS has a very specific methodology that it uses to identify national security concerns. We can talk about that if you're interested. It involves looking at threats, vulnerabilities, and consequences. It's this whole matrix and a very formal system. But if they've identified a national security concern, then they have to do a few things. One, they look to see if there are other authorities of the U.S. government that would, you know, appropriately address that national security concern. So that could be other authorities like export controls is one we talked about. It could be, you know, economic sanctions authorities under OFAC or that kind of thing. If they determine that there's no other authority available to the U.S. government that's adequate and appropriate, they will see if they can mitigate the risk to national security by entering into an agreement with the parties where the parties promise, you know, to make certain undertakings to address the national security concern. That could be things like we won't give the foreign acquirer in, you know, access to certain technology, you know, that type of thing. But sometimes CFIUS says, you know, we've identified a risk, there's no other authority, and we don't think this risk can actually be mitigated, right? For various reasons. It could be that the risk is too significant. you know, the harm that would result from the risk manifesting is too significant to U.S. national security. It could be that they don't trust the parties to appropriately implement the mitigation measures, right? So they might go to the parties and say, we've identified this risk and we don't think it can be resolved. And if you parties do not voluntarily withdraw and abandon this transaction, we CFIUS have no other choice but to recommend to the president that the president prohibit the transaction.
And you said there's been two cases where the president has accepted or rejected a CFIUS review?
No. In the history of CFIUS, there have been eight at this point, I believe.
Okay.
That have actually gone to a full presidential prohibition.
And which are the most recent? Those are public, right?
They are public. They are public. TikTok is a recent one.
And TikTok went to whom? What president?
That was in the Trump administration. Yeah. It was a presidential order that, interestingly, and we can talk about TikTok more. Interestingly, was never fully implemented. Mm-hmm. The president issued, a presidential order coming out of the CFIUS process, but then, ByteDance, the Chinese owner of TikTok, has of course continued to own TikTok since then, and there's legislation now that might change that in the next, couple weeks. But that was one of the presidential orders that wasn't actually kind of fully enforced. But there have been other, other recent ones. Ikestron was under the end of the Obama administration. I believe that was a semiconductor transaction. Stay in Touch, that was a transaction that involved hotel software. And so there've been various ones over the years. Qualcomm was another, big one, the Qualcomm Broadcom.
Oh, right.
Transaction. So almost all of the ones that have been, kind of full presidential prohibitions have been related to China. There was actually a presidential prohibition earlier this year coming out of CFIUS where the president prohibited a Chinese company from acquiring land near a U.S. military facility in Wyoming. And the acquirer, the Chinese acquirer, had purchased the land to start a Bitcoin mining operation or a cryptocurrency mining operation. And CFIUS recommended that the president prohibit the transaction, and the president did end up prohibiting the transaction due to kind of proximity concerns because the facility was very close to a sensitive military base.
That's very interesting. And let me add a question here. Cryptocurrency, where has this fallen in the CFIUS concern? I mean, we've seen since Trump has won the election that cryptocurrency is on the up for a while. It seemed like the regulatory enforcement was very strong. But, we see Bitcoin at $100,000 and many other cryptos that are ascendant. And there is a geopolitical connotation to this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, when people think of cryptocurrency and kind of geopolitics, you probably think more about the ability to use cryptocurrency to evade things like, sanctions, economic sanctions or other controlled economic activity. And so, money laundering, that type of thing, right? In the CFIUS context, certainly the technology, blockchain technology and related technologies can have deep national security implications, but in terms of kind of public activity in cryptocurrency or Bitcoin, I think this Mine One, this real estate kind of transaction was the most public CFIUS action, which was related less to the technology itself and more to the location of where the acquirer wanted to put their facility.
All right. So let's talk about TikTok, because TikTok is probably the most prominent case and very public. Interestingly, Trump in his first administration opposed this. He's been talking about now embracing TikTok, but I remember there was an idea of divesting the U.S. entity, and there was talk of Oracle or Microsoft, the one U.S. company, of acquiring. That never happened. So it's still to be seen what happens. There are very prominent investors. And the company ByteDance is billions of dollars. It's a very big case. Where does it stand now? And is it still, subject to politics and nobody really knows what's going to happen here?
Yeah, so I should start by saying I'm not involved in the litigation or anything with TikTok. So no inside knowledge. Everything I say will just be, you know, based on what I've read in the press and that kind of thing. But where it stands is, you know, there was a law passed, the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, or PFACA, that essentially had the effect of forcing ByteDance to, you know, sell TikTok, to divest TikTok, or TikTok would be banned in the United States, essentially. And that law is going to take effect, absent, you know, judicial intervention, is slated to take effect in January. And so as of January 19th, I believe, you know, if TikTok is not divested, it will be kind of banned in the United States. TikTok has challenged the constitutionality of this legislation. The DC Circuit very recently came out with an order finding for the US government, in other words, upholding the constitutionality of the law. TikTok has indicated that they will be appealing that and seeking an injunction to ensure that the law does not go into effect while they appeal it. But that's currently, you know, in litigation right now. So it's a very current and timely issue. The ultimate resolution, of course, is unclear, but unless there's judicial intervention, the law, you know, would ban TikTok essentially as of January.
Yeah, no, it's going to be very interesting to see. You know, another development is outbound investments. And I don't know where it stands now, but a few years ago, there was a push to not only review inbound investments coming into the United States, but US investments into China and other jurisdictions that are considered to be rivals or problematic for national security measures. And it wasn't only investments, but you know, activities from US persons in those countries. And that push was from the US and the EU and different laws. Where does that stand now?
Yeah, great question. The U.S. version of that, this outbound investment regime, is slated to take effect in just a few weeks. So we are now at the point where we are actually going to have, as of January 2nd, an outbound investment security regime for essentially the first time in U.S. history. And you know, the origins of it, I think, are understandable, right? If you kind of look at it from the perspective of there are certain technologies and products that, you know, for various national security reasons, we don't want the Chinese government to have, right? And we can control that through things like export controls, right? Tools that we can, you know, authorities that the US government has available to it to control those types of things. However, you know, we were in a situation where, you know, a US business may be prohibited from exporting a certain item to China. But that same US business could go fund a Chinese company trying to develop in China the exact same technology, right? And so you were in this kind of odd situation where, you know, the US government was trying to ensure that, you know, the Chinese government didn't have access to some technology, but a US business could go fund the development of that product or technology. And so I think, you know, policymakers and national security regulators looked at this and said, well, this can't, you know, this can't be the right answer. Right. And that led to the discussions. Now, one thing that China does not lack is money, right? In certain ways, or the ability, you know, from the state level to provide funding to national security priorities, right? So it was always recognized, I think, that simply kind of turning off US dollars was probably not going to achieve your goal, right? Because if money is fungible and those US dollars can just be replaced by, you know, funding from the Chinese government, then you're not doing much, right? But so policymakers said, no, this isn't just about the money. This is more about the intangibles that go along with US businesses, US persons funding these, you know, companies and activities. And that's, you know, the intangibles like management expertise, networks, you know, all the things that you know well from sitting in Silicon Valley. You know, when you make an investment, it's not just the dollars, it's the relationships, it's the connections, it's the expertise, you know, all of those things. And so what the new outbound investment regime does is says, you know, if there are US investments in certain sectors, and we can talk about what they are in Chinese companies, and that's going to kind of defined broadly. then those are either going to be, you have to notify them to the U.S. government, or they're going to be prohibited. But then there's a lot of exceptions, and the exceptions take out transactions that are more kind of just funding transactions. And so what you're left with is, you know, investments in three sectors in China. It's artificial intelligence, it's semiconductors and microelectronics, and it's quantum computing. It's those three that will fall under this new regime. Interestingly and importantly, it is not kind of a reverse CFIUS in the sense that it's not a case-by-case transaction review that leads to, you know, an approval for a specific transaction. Rather, it's just two buckets of two categories of transactions, one that has to be notified to the U.S. government, the other is just flat prohibited. Mm.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see because, as you said, it's the first time and, you know, there's been a push on freedom and, you know, what does this mean for people? I understand as well that even if you're a U.S. person and you want to sit on a board of a quantum computer company in China, you will not be able to do that anymore in any of these categories.
It's more that you won't, if you do that, you will not be able to participate in decision-making around one of these transactions, right? Mm-hmm. So it is kind of transaction-based in that sense. It wouldn't be a blanket prohibition on, for example, serving on a board, but it would be a U.S. person would not be able to kind of be participating in a transaction that would be covered by the new regime.
Okay. I mean, I know at least sitting here in Silicon Valley that a lot of firms have separated their operations from China and the US. Sequoia most famously had its firm in India and China, and they decided to separate the firm. Very big decision. And they tend to lead as one of the top firms a lot of these trends. And it's harder and harder also for LPs, right, to invest in this, and it gets muddled through the LP, GP, and what goes on. And to me, at least in the last 5 years, on the board level, there's been a geopolitical push where people are saying we have to decouple, or we got to get out of China. And that's been a lot of tension because for so long, a lot of the tech companies have been working together that it's interesting how that will work out. And there's now, I think in the Biden administration, there was a push to do an industrial policy, new regulation, EVs and the CHIPS Act and all these new regulations. What do you think about that? Because, you know, who knows what the new administration is going to be doing, but it seems like at least the industrial policy of China, which was to target these technologies, and we can talk about solar industry and now the EV, the battery industry, right? Critical minerals and all of that. And it seems like they are much more advanced. How do you think about this decoupling? Is it changed lately? And how do you see this moving forward?
Yeah. These are the exact issues of the day and the exact issues that, you know, boardrooms need to be thinking about. How do these issues affect their businesses, right? And so I think it's a great question. It's great that you're addressing it and your listeners are thinking about it. In terms of decoupling, you know, as you know, the Biden administration has been very wary of using that term, right? They prefer de-risking, right? It is a way of signifying that they recognize that complete separation of the economies of the two nations is really untenable at this point, right? It would lead to such, you know, massive economic upheaval that would be, you know, unhealthy for both countries, right? And so they've preferred kind of this de-risking approach, and you know, they talk a lot about the small yard, high fence approach, right, of protecting a narrowly described set of technologies or industries or sectors or whatever, and putting you know, very high walls around those, but otherwise sticking to the typical U.S. kind of open investment environment and open economy. I think in my mind, the Trump administration is likely to be a bit more aggressive on this front. You know, I think that they will also recognize that full kind of decoupling and full separation is not, you know, feasible in the near term. But I do think they are probably likely to be a little bit more aggressive than the Biden administration was in talking about these types of issues and using various policy tools to create incentives that will make U.S. businesses think twice about kind of further engaging or expanding in China. And likewise, will make Chinese businesses think twice about, you know, investing in the United States.
Well, for them, it's almost out of bounds at this stage for a Chinese investing here. And I just noticed that Jacob Hellberg has been nominated as Undersecretary of State. He's been very vocal on this idea of China. So that signals a little bit where this administration will be taking this debate, right?
Absolutely. I think you're seeing, you know, the classic personnel is policy, right? You're seeing a lot of the nominees and appointees come from the more kind of China hawk camp, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. I think is going to influence mm-hmm. policy. In terms of, you know, the industrial policy question, that's an interesting one, right? Because, of course, you know, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States has been more averse to kind of mm-hmm. getting involved in a significant way in industrial policy than many other developed economies. And maybe you could say that in the history of the United States, we've been more averse, but that doesn't mean we haven't had industrial policy in the past, right? Of course, we have, going back to Hamilton, and you can look at, you know, New Deal, you can look at mobilizations during World War II, you know, you can look at the space race, right, during mm-hmm. the Cold War, you know, all of these various ways that the U.S. government has kind of played a role in advancing, you know, technologies or sectors that it sees as strategic, right? And so I think where we are from my perspective is we're going through another one of these, you know, call it whatever you want, a wave or a cycle or, you know, the pendulum swinging, but policymakers have recognized exactly what you were describing, which is we now have a kind of, you know, strategic competitor, an adversary, whatever you want to call it, near peer competitor, stalking threat, you know, all of these different terms are thrown around when discussing China. But there's a recognition that the Chinese system has, from a state level, provided such great support in so many of these important technology areas that we are either, you know, kind of just ahead or in some circumstances behind, as you were saying, in critical areas of technology development. And so policymakers are looking at this and saying, well, we're in a different position than we were at the end of the Cold War. We're in a different position than we were in the 90s and the early 2000s, right? We're now in a position where, in order to maintain our technological advantage, our military advantage, we need to ensure that the U.S. government from a state level is putting you know, priorities around some of these things, including by funding and through the various mechanisms that you delineated. And so I think that this is, you know, a change from the recent past, but it is not unheard of in U.S. history. And I think if you look at it from a kind of broader perspective, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, and I can think of different industries and thinking of defense where Silicon Valley has become more prominent and Palantir and Adapar and other companies that are really pushing in that direction to be more de-risk or decouple from, you know, different adversaries or whatever we want to address them like. Is there any other board issue that we did not address and that you think would be important to highlight for corporate directors in this matter of national security?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I would say is national security is a much broader concept than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And that carries through, you know, not only CFIUS, but all these other regulatory regimes. And, you know, it used to be that if you talked about national security in kind of a business context, you were talking about big defense contractors, mm-hmm. right? The companies that were making planes and tanks and, you know, bombs and that kind of thing. Today, when you talk about national security, you're talking about things like batteries mm-hmm. and solar, right? And AI. And these are all things that, you know, are touching many, many companies that do not think of themselves as national security companies, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I would say to any board member is think about this new definition of national security and how your company fits into that, because it's not enough to say, oh, we don't make defense articles. We don't supply the U.S. military. We don't, you know, we're not a government contractor. That's not the right way to think about it. And if you wait until you have a big transaction or some transformative venture to for the first time kind of really think deeply about how your company plugs into this new national security architecture, it's going to be too late.
Yeah, and certainly in deal making, right, we've seen China investing in Africa and Latin America and doing many more deals with the US. China, there's a national policy of saying, you know, we're going to push this industry and we're going to fund you through state loans and other issues. And it's a different playing field. And I think that's interesting, where it's a different practice on how to address these issues. And sometimes if you're a US company and you want to bid for a company, the stock price is X, and you're not going to pay over that. And maybe China doesn't care about that price because they have an industrial policy that they want to own the market. And it's a long game, right? And that complicates the review of these deals.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. All of these things need to be taken into account as you know, board members are thinking about the direction of their companies. Mm.
All right. Let's go into the rapid fire questions. What are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'll give you two that that I tend to return to frequently. Mm-hmm. Is the way that I was kind of thinking about it. So the first is Wind, Sand, and Stars, mm-hmm. by Saint-Exupéry. It's a, you know, kind of chronicle, autobiographical chronicle of you know, his time as an aviator. But more than aviation, I found it's a really, really amazing book about humanity and human nature. And, you know, I kind of turn back to it frequently because there are just so many nuggets of wisdom in it. When he, you know, one of my favorite, he's talking about an airplane, right? But he's got this quote, in anything at all, perfection is finally attained, not when there's no longer anything to add, but when there's no longer anything to take away, right? And he's talking about an airplane, but I just, that to me is so profound. And I think about that in so many things from, you know, when I'm doing some writing and, you know, do I need this sentence? No, I can take away this sentence. It's not essential, right? Perfection is achieved when there's no longer anything that I can't remove, mm-hmm. right? I have to make sure every single thing is essential. Mm-hmm. To other aspects of life, right? And then I just find there's so many of those kind of nuggets in that book.
It's interesting that you picked that one and not The Little Prince, which is what most people would pick from Saint-Exupéry.
Yeah. It's his more famous, right? Yeah. But Wind, Sand, and Stars and Night Flight is another good one. These are books I think I was originally introduced to in high school. And for whatever reason, Wind, Sand, and Stars, it just, you know, keeps coming back.
Okay.
And the other one is much less profound. It's, you know, Strunk and White's Elements of Style, which is just, okay. You know, a writing. It's a writing guide that, you know, as the son of a journalist, it was kind of long, you know, beaten into my brain that you need to be succinct and clear and concise and, you know, don't use big words when small words will do. And, you know, tell people what they need to know, right? And so that I think is an excellent book that I open frequently.
Love it. Okay, who are your mentors and what did you learn from them?
Too many to name is the short answer. I have been blessed to have had really excellent leaders and mentors in kind of every endeavor I've ever been involved in. You know, when I start to think about them, it goes back to my high school track coach, Laddie Lawrence. It goes through the judges that I clerked for, you know, Alan Nevis, Janet Hall. It goes through, you know, almost I've had a boss or multiple bosses at every organization that I've worked in that I've learned something from. And I'm very grateful to all of them. And it's been very different. You know, you can imagine, you know, learning from my partners at Cravath is different than learning from my bosses at the White House, which is different than learning from, you know, law school professors and that kind of thing. But I think all of them have shared, you know, a kind of view of the world that sees the humans in whatever they're doing, whether it's, you know, being a judge or working on a corporate transaction or working in government, you know, understands the effect on individual people in whatever you're doing. And I think that's something that I've kind of taken away from a lot of my mentors.
All right. Excellent. Are there any quotes you think of often or live your life by, maybe in addition to the one you just said?
I really love and think about frequently, especially these days, Judge Learned Hand's Spirit of Liberty speech, right? This is the one that talks about, you know, what is liberty and what do we say? What do we mean when we say we seek liberty? And he talks about, you know, whether he wonders if our hopes for liberty rest too much on constitutions and laws and courts, and says that these are false hopes, right? Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, nor court can do much to help it. But while it lies there, it needs no constitution, no law, or no court to save it, right? And it's kind of, as a lawyer and as somebody who's been fortunate to be involved in the policymaking process, I think this is so true, right? We can't just expect the laws to do all the work, right? People need to be cognizant of what those laws are and why they're there and really be involved in the process of upholding, you know, the democratic values that you know, make America great. So that's a good one. And then just, you know, something to live your life by. Be prepared is the Boy Scout motto. I was a scout when I was a kid. I now have two sons in the scout program. And that's a great one. Just, you know, my son said to me, you know, be prepared for what? And like, that's the point for anything, right? Just be prepared, right? There's nothing after that. Just be prepared.
I like that. All right. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
An absurd thing that I love is probably one that you and I share, which is the game of rugby, I think for many Americans in particular, where it's not, you know, the most popular sport, look at it and say, this is an entirely absurd endeavor. You've got, you know, 30 people running around, running into each other. You know, nobody seems to be able to figure out what's going on, but it's the most fun team sport I've ever played. I love that there's, you know, a position for everybody. You've got the big guys, you've got the small, fast guys. Everybody plays a role. It's a real team effort. I don't play tackle anymore. I still play in a kind of old man touch league, and I love every minute of it.
Yeah, no, I have to say that it is the best team sport where it's embedded to have a third half, have a game of rugby, share beers afterwards. You know, you fight in the field, but then afterwards everybody's together. And you know, I've made friends all over the world through rugby, and I think it's a wonderful sport. All right, final question. Which living person do you most admire?
It's my wife, hands down. She is a psychologist. She knew from her kind of teenage years that she wanted to be a psychologist, went and got a PhD from Duke, did an internship at Johns Hopkins, you know, had this brilliant academic career. She was publishing all the time. She was doing research and writing. When we left DC, she pivoted into a private practice, you know, started her own small business, which she's been successful in, you know, took a real risk, you know, now has a couple employees, just stuff that I look at and say, wow. Right. And she did, you know, does all this while raising our four kids and having a husband who, you know, probably works too much, right? So that was an easy one. I admire her every day.
Okay. Well, on that note, Ben, thank you so much to talk to me. And it's great to reconnect with you. And you have acquired so much knowledge in this narrow CFIUS area, in addition to many others. But it's great to have this discussion, particularly for directors to understand what is this CFIUS thing and how should they think about transactions that are way more important now in this national security phase that we are in, which I think is going to be increasingly more important.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the time. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can check out all the details related to this podcast at the website boardroom-governance.com. And please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.